Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 447, Update on September 11th and Related Matters. This is being recorded on February 29th of the year 2004. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, more recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to a longer URL that is linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio-equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, sometimes as much as 2 weeks, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record Program 447 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. By the way, the Spitfire website is now equipped with a search engine. Use it like Google or one of the other search engines. If you want to look for something, put the item you want to search for in quotes, and it will search the annotated For the Record programs. Okay, so a tip of the hat to a listener for putting that together for us. In this broadcast, we're going to be, obviously, as indicated by the title, updating various aspects of the events in and around September 11th. One of the things that I want to point out at the beginning is the multiplicity of motivations that is applicable in understanding some of the things that we're going to be talking about. Some of the people and some of the institutions are motivated by ideology, either political ideology and or religious fervor, and still others are motivated by economic factors, basically. One of the metaphors that I want to suggest to people is that of a malaria-bearing mosquito. It bites someone and in the process transmits the malaria disease to the person it's biting, but it's not biting somebody in order to give them malaria. It's biting in order to obtain blood to reproduce. However, of course, in that transaction and as a fundamental element of that transaction from the standpoint of the thing that gets bitten, it gets malaria. But again, the malaria-bearing mosquito is not biting someone in order to give them malaria. And within the context of structural economic relationships, and this is very, very important, within the context of structural economic relationships, a number of ideologically and or religiously motivated elements operate, and they often receive a profound element of assistance from the structural economic relationships themselves, because those relationships are deemed to be inviolable in terms of a legal investigation. But the people who often are providing the religious or ideologically motivated operants or elements with their protection are not necessarily doing so for ideological or religious reasons. This is an important consideration. Now, we're going to be looking at a big way in that the Bush administration's, or Bush administration's plural, involvement in obfuscating investigations into September 11th, and in some cases into events that could have prevented September 11th or things that are attendant upon September 11th but took place a decade or more ago. Beginning with this article from the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, February 15th of 2004, in the Mercury's National News in Brief section, we read the following. Bush will meet with few September 11th panel members. The White House said Saturday that President Bush plans to meet with only a limited number of representatives from the commission investigating the September 11th terrorist attacks, despite a statement issued Friday that suggested he would meet with the whole panel. The new details surprised some commission officials and members who believed they had secured a promise from Bush for a meeting with all 10 members and could add to the tensions that have strained relations between the two sides. It would be impossible within the purview of this broadcast to delineate all of the various ways in which Bush has or people in his administration have obfuscated investigations into September 11th, but they are many, and there are many broadcasts that talk about that. President Bush has put together a commission that will be investigating intelligence failures, in particular with regard to the invasion of Iraq and also with regard to September 11th. As noted in For the Record Program 445, one of the people who's going to be a co-chair of this commission, Judge Lawrence Silberman himself has a background that would suggest that any work that he does will be seriously biased, because he is a participant in many of the aspects of the two Bush administrations that Kevin Phillips, in his book American Dynasty, labeled the Wars of the Texas Succession. It appears that some of the institutional connections and some of the economic fields of operation of various members of this commission will be off limits. From the New York Times of February 15th of 2004, an article by Eric Lichtblau, Dateline, Washington, February 14th, and headlined, Intelligence Panel's Finances Will Stay Private. The White House is declining to make public the financial histories of the commissioners President Bush appointed to investigate American intelligence failures. Administration officials say the arrangement has helped to attract the best qualified people for the panel, but critics say the White House's refusal to disclose financial information raises questions about potential conflicts of interest that could cloud the commission's work. Citing an exemption to federal ethics regulations, the White House says the financial disclosure statements filed by the commission's nine members will remain confidential because they are not being paid for their work. And among the interesting entanglements concerns Lloyd Cutler, a member of the panel, and his connections, or the connections between his law firm, Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, and the Carlyle Group, a huge equity firm that is inextricably linked not only with the Bush family, but also with the Bin Laden families and other elements of the Saudi and American power elites. It is in the context of institutions like the Carlyle Group that we find Bush and the forces around him linked with some of the Saudi members of the power elite, which are implicated in helping to fund the operations of Al-Qaeda and linked also with the Muslim Brotherhood. Returning once again to the New York Times article, also on the panel is Lloyd M. Cutler, a prominent Washington lawyer who has served in several Democratic administrations. The firm he founded, Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, has done work for the Carlyle Group, a large Washington equity firm that has used former President George Bush and other well-connected Republicans to advance its interests in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. Mr. Cutler said in an interview, however, that he had not personally represented the Carlyle Group. Well, actually, their main counsel is Baker Botts. That's the firm of James Baker. And so it's not surprising that Cutler personally would not have been involved in representing Carlyle Group. Another area in which the Bush administration finds itself entangled, and that concerns the lawsuit that has been filed by survivors of the victims of September 11th. In For the Record program number 431, we noted that the Riggs National Bank is a bank in which the Saudi embassy and other embassies have accounts, and one of the Saudi embassy accounts in the Riggs National Bank is being investigated in connection with the alleged funneling of money from a Saudi princess to people involved with the events of September 11th. An article about that appeared in the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, February 26th of 2004. Article by Glenn R. Simpson headlined, Lawyers for Victims of 9/11 Seek Riggs Records on Saudi Accounts. It reads in part as follows. Lawyers for the victims of September 11th, 2001 terror attacks have subpoenaed Riggs National Corporation of Washington, seeking information on its handling of the Embassy of Saudi Arabia's bank accounts. Attorneys are demanding access to a report by federal banking regulators that accuses Riggs of failing to maintain proper controls on the Saudi accounts, through which hundreds of millions of dollars flow annually for embassy operations and Saudi programs in the U.S. The report by the Office of the Comptroller of Currency details alleged lapses by the bank in connection with funds that flowed to two of the September 11th hijackers. Among other things, regulators found that Riggs failed to file reports on suspicious activity involving tens of millions of dollars of transactions by Saudi diplomats, their families, and employees. Skipping down. The Federal Bureau of Investigation says that an undetermined sum of money from the accounts of Princess Haifa al-Faisal, wife of Saudi ambassador to the U.S. Bandar bin Sultan, flowed to terrorists Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar through a third Saudi man, Omar al-Bayoumi. The Saudis say Princess Haifa didn't intend to give any money to the two men. According to people familiar with the matter, a discussion of the accounts of Riggs were among the things the Bush administration insisted on removing from the public version of the 850-page Congressional Intelligence Report on the attacks. The accounts are also part of a continuing FBI investigation into Saudi financial activity in the U.S. By the way, George Bush's uncle, Jonathan Bush, is a director of Riggs Bank. A listener turned me on to a very important article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. This is Harper's Magazine's issue of March of 2004. And in this, there's an article by David Armstrong, which talks about the Bush administration's connections to the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. It also talks about the attempts by people connected to the Bush administration, such as Grover Norquist and Talat Otman, to basically interdict this administration. They interceded with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill on behalf of the targets of the investigation. Of course, Paul O'Neill shortly thereafter resigned from the administration. Again, credit on this to a listener from Harper's Magazine's issue of March of 2004. This is an article called Charity Cases, subtitled Why Has the Bush Administration Failed to Stop Saudi Funding of Terrorism? And after discussing a vow that Bush took on September 20th of 2001 to interdict the funds that helped to make terrorism viable, Al-Qaeda in particular, David Armstrong writes, "But despite those efforts, the United States has made only limited progress in blocking the funding of terrorists. Al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorist groups remain well-financed. And one of their major sources of funding, a network of Islamic charities financed by Saudi Arabia, remains relatively uninterrupted. It's tough talk notwithstanding, the Bush administration has failed to take decisive action against this significant source of terror financing, in part, it seems, to protect the government of Saudi Arabia and its friends in Washington. The Bush administration has adopted an approach to Saudi terrorist funding that would best be described as hands-off. For example, last summer it censored the 28 pages on the subject from a congressional report on the September 11th attacks and refused to release the names of Saudi entities suspected to be financiers of terrorism." Skipping down. "In other cases, the Bush administration made a conscious decision not to pursue major Saudi conduits for terrorist funding. The clearest example involves two ostensible charities that are long known to have funneled money to Al-Qaeda, the International Islamic Relief Organization, or IIRO, and the Muslim World League. Both are financed directly by the Saudi government. MWL, or the Muslim World League, by the way, something we're going to come back to later, is an evangelical organization that was created to help spread Wahhabism, the Saudi brand of Islamic fundamentalism. IIRO is a humanitarian relief organization that operates primarily in Muslim countries. Yet a 1996 CIA report alleged that IIRO helped to fund six militant training camps in Afghanistan and noted that the former head of the group's Philippine office, Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law, had been linked to plots to, quote, target the Pope and U.S. airlines, unquote. U.S. intelligence officials also believe that Muslim World League employees were involved in the 1998 bombing of two U.S. embassies in Africa. Although both IIRO and MWL were known to have funded Al-Qaeda, U.S. government sources indicated to Newsweek in October 2001 that the Bush administration left the two organizations off the list of designated terrorist groups in order to spare the Saudi government from embarrassment. On top of this, the most promising domestic inquiry into these Saudi groups has been dismantled. In March of 2002, as part of a Customs Service investigation known as Operation Green Quest, government investigators raided the Virginia offices of IIRO and Muslim World League, along with a number of other Saudi-backed charities and businesses. Although the raids turned up concrete evidence that elements of the network had funded individuals and groups designated as terrorists by the United States, no assets have been frozen, and the few belated arrests in this case have been made on charges unrelated to terrorist financing. In particular, Abdurrahman Alamoudi, who heads a group called the Success Foundation, which in the late 1990s absorbed the U.S. operations of IIRO, has been charged only with accepting money from Libya and with immigration violations, despite evidence seized from the offices of Success and other groups he controls for their material support, not just for Hamas, but for two known al-Qaeda fronts. Alamoudi was once caught on tape remarking that he disapproved of the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa only because no Americans were killed, and that instead he preferred more strategic targets such as the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, which had been bombed in 1994. Now, under an agreement between Attorney General John Ashcroft and Department of Homeland Security head Tom Ridge, signed in May of 2003, the Customs Service, part of Homeland Security since last March, has relinquished control of its counterterrorism investigations to the FBI, which repeatedly had refused to turn over critical investigative files to Green Quest agents. This deal between Ashcroft and Ridge effectively shut down Green Quest, quashing the one serious, if flawed, probe into domestic terrorist financing. By the way, bear in mind that Robert Mueller, who heads up the FBI, had been the U.S. attorney who presided over the BCCI investigation and was less than vigorous in pursuing that. The BCCI investigation opened up on conduits which would implicate both the administration of the elder George Bush and also people connected to the younger George Bush in terrorism and other very sordid activities. Good discussion of that in FTR program number 310. Continuing with this article, part of the Bush administration's reluctance to confront the Saudis over terrorist financing may have less to do with embarrassing a key ally in the Middle East than with embarrassing the United States itself. Cracking down on IIRO and Muslim World League, for example, would threaten to expose not only Saudi support of terrorism, but also America's own role in helping to create what eventually would become part of al-Qaeda's funding network. During the 1980s, the United States actively promoted the use of these and other Islamic charities as part of a joint U.S.-Saudi effort to fund the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. And, skipping down, bear in mind something we talked about in For the Record program 442, Youssef Nada and Ali Galeb Himat, two of the primary functionaries in the Al-Taqwa network, had six children in the United States between 1979 and 1984, according to an Italian intelligence report. I suspect that their presence in the United States was in conjunction with the Afghan Mujahideen support effort. Skipping down. By the way, al-Taqwa very strongly connected to the aforementioned Abdurrahman Alamoudi, the fellow talked about a few minutes ago. Abdurrahman Alamoudi, by the way, has Grover Norquist as his lobbyist in the United States. And we're going to talk about Grover Norquist, one of the kingpins in the Republican Party and a major advisor to the Bush administration over tax policies in just a minute. Skipping down and continuing, it was at that point, in the midst of the first Bush administration, that Osama bin Laden began transforming the Mujahideen funding network into a support structure for his newly created anti-Western jihadist organization, al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, elements of the erstwhile Mujahideen funding network, most notably IIRO and MWL, were expanding their operations and establishing offices worldwide, including in the United States. During the next decade, these organizations became prime conduits for Saudi financing of groups including al-Qaeda, now regarded by the United States as terrorist organizations. So looking at what we just covered, it was during the administration of the first George Bush, George I, that some of these funding conduits set up to aid the Afghan Mujahideen effort were transformed into al-Qaeda funding conduits, and later on we're going to take a look at the first Bush administration's laxity in pursuing indications that Pakistan, among other nations, was getting their hands on nuclear technology through rather disturbing means. I guess it's disturbing in and of itself, but we're going to take a look at the nuclear smuggling and the first Bush administration's unwillingness to pursue that, Also, apparently out of fear of complicating the Afghan Mujahideen situation, we're going to look at that later on in the broadcast. Coming back to the article from Harper's Magazine of March of 2004, thus, the Islamic terrorism financing structure that the Bush administration now proposes to crush is in part an outgrowth of the Reagan-Bush administration's Cold War effort to undermine the Soviet Union, a classic example of blowback. For the Bush administration to designate groups such as IIRO and MWL as terrorist financiers would risk unwelcome questions about the wisdom of having funded and trained an army of Islamic militants. Doing so would also expose the intelligence community to criticism for its failure to adequately monitor these former allies and their extensive funding network. But the dilemma for the Bush administration extends far beyond issues of history. Many prominent politicians, not least among them the Bushes, have for years maintained close political, business, and personal dealings with the Saudi royal family and, more generally, Saudi interests. The extent of the administration's difficulties on this front became clear shortly after the Green Quest raids in March of 2002. Just 2 weeks after the Customs Task Force raided the Saudi-backed groups in Northern Virginia, two leading Muslim activists with ties to the groups were allowed to meet with Paul O'Neill, then the Secretary of the Treasury Department, which at that time controlled customs, to complain about the conduct of the raids. The meeting was arranged by Grover Norquist, the influential Republican activist. Norquist is also the founder and former chair of the Islamic Institute, a conservative Muslim outreach group in which both of the men who met O'Neill are officers, and which has received funding from some of the raided individuals and groups, including Abdurrahman Alamoudi. And the connections do not end there. One of the Muslim activists who met with O'Neill was Talat Otman, a longtime friend and former business associate of President Bush. The two served together on the board of the Texas-based oil company Harkin Energy starting in the late 1980s and have remained close ever since. Otman sat on Harkin's board as the representative of Abdullah Taha Baksh, a Saudi business magnate and a close associate of suspected terrorist financier Khalid bin Mahfouz. Baksh now heads an oil company that is a subsidiary of Halliburton, the energy giant formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney. By the way, Baksh also, at one point, according to the book Forbidden Truth, was a business representative for the bin Laden family. Note that he now works for a Halliburton Oil subsidiary. And it was as a protege of Abdullah Taha Baksh that Talat Otman found his way into Harkin Energy and the Bush camp. By the way, Talat Otman gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in the year 2000. Continuing, in addition to his work at the Islamic Institute, Otman serves on the board of Amana Mutual Funds Trust, an Islamic investment group that had close ties to raided entities and yet was not itself targeted. At the time of the Green Quest raids in March of 2002, at least four figures from the targeted groups were affiliated with Amana, including M. Yaqub Mirza, the individual who set up the U.S. branch of the Muslim World League, the fundraising arm of the U.S. branch of IIRO, and many of the other raided organizations. Despite Mirza's presence on the board, and despite the fact that large sums of money from the suspect groups have moved through Amana, Green Quest Raids chose not to raid that firm. By the way, discussion of the Republican GOP ethnic outreach links through the Islamic Institute to these organizations that were apparently funding Al-Qaeda and Hamas, it's discussed in many programs. FTR 356, 357, and 359 talk about it. It's also discussed in FTR 376, FTR 415, and FTR 435. So do look into those programs. As we looked at in For the Record 425, among other broadcasts, after the Operation Green Quest raids took place, the FBI and CIA began surveilling the investigators who had helped to launch the Operation Green Quest raids. Among those was a woman named Rita Katz, who runs an investigative agency and think tank on terrorism in Washington, D.C. She did some of the important legwork on Operation Green Quest, and she published a book called Terrorist Hunter under the pseudonym Anonymous in 2003. We accessed that and among other programs for the record 425. And we're going to recapitulate a portion of the text from that book. And this concerns the CIA and FBI surveillance of the people who had launched Operation Green Quest. Quote, "The CIA was investigating me and the SAR investigators from Green Quest and Customs. The CIA and the FBI investigated everyone who had anything to do with the SAR investigation. White vans and SUVs with dark windows appeared near all the homes of the SAR investigators. All agents, some of whom were very experienced with surveillance, knew they were being followed. So was I. I felt that I was being followed everywhere and watched at home, in the supermarket, on the way to work. And for what? The customs agents were questioned. That's the customs agents involved in Green Quest. So were their supervisors. So was the U.S. attorney on the SAR case. One of the questions they were all asked was whether they'd leaked material to me. They all kept saying that this was the most preposterous idea. They all said that before I came, none of them had the slightest clue about SAR and 555 Grove Street. They said there was nothing of value they could give me that I didn't have already. That it was I who gave them the material and not the other way around. None of the investigated parties has the slightest clue as to the real reason they were being investigated. Risking criticism for being unfoundedly paranoid, I must convey my theory about the investigation and the CIA's involvement in it. I don't know for certain what's the deal with the CIA investigating the SAR investigators, but it sure feels as if someone in that agency doesn't like the idea that the Saudi Arabian boat is being rocked. The raids on 555 had already taken place. The CIA couldn't change that, but investigating and giving the people behind the raids a hard time is a most efficient way of making sure the SAR investigation stops there. Which, come to think of it, may be the reason the government looks so unfavorably on the lawsuit filed by 9/11 victims' families against several Saudi entities and individuals, accusing them of funding terrorism and seeking damages." Unquote. And we'll continue with our look at some of these tangled webs in the second side of the program. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL, linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record Program 447 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com within a week or so of the airing of this broadcast. At the beginning of each For the Record description, there is a page to click on for people that have inquired about helping to assist the work that I'm doing, and there have been a number of those inquiries. Just go to the top of each description and click on the page that indicates how to support the work that I'm doing. By the way, the For the Record section descriptions now have a search engine so that people can search the descriptions in order to locate particular items. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 447. Update on September 11th and related matters. This is being recorded on September 29th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.